This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A number of Israel's important military bases are hit with Hezbollah's missiles as the movement launches fresh retaliatory operations against the regime. Israel keeps pounding Gaza, indiscriminately raising the death toll from the regime's genocidal war to over 43,700. And pro-Palestinian protesters rally in Paris over France hosting Israeli football team for a Nations League match. The Israeli carnage in Lebanon shows no sign of abating. The regime has carried out fresh attacks on the Dahiya suburb in the capital, Beirut. Footage shows smoke is billowing over Dahiya's Gubairi area following Israeli air raids. The number of casualties and the extent of the damage are unclear, but reports say that several buildings were destroyed there. To the south of the Arab country, four Lebanese paramedics were among six people killed in an Israeli strike on a civil defense center in the Nabatea area. Dozens of rescue workers were also killed in Israeli attacks on the eastern city of Baalbek. The death toll from the Israeli aggression since October last year is now near 3,400. More than 14,400 others have been wounded. A new report by the World Bank says Israel's brutal aggression against Lebanon has inflicted huge economic and physical losses on the country. The report put economic losses suffered by the country at more than $5 billion. It added that additional damage to physical structures also amounted to over $3 billion. According to the World Bank, nearly 100,000 housing units have been destroyed, mainly in Lebanon south, and around 166,000 people have lost their jobs. It cited commerce, tourism, hospitality and agriculture as the main sectors hit by Israel's aggression. The bank also estimated that the Israeli war on Lebanon will cut the country's real GDP growth for 2024 by at least 6.6%. Hezbollah has carried out fresh retaliatory operations against Israeli military sites and settlements deep inside the occupied territories. The group targeted Israel's Tel Haim base in Tel Aviv for the first time with a volley of missiles. The base is run by the Military Intelligence Division of the Israeli Army. Hezbollah also hit the Stella Maris naval monitoring and surveillance base northwest of Haifa with a barrage of missiles. Earlier, the Lebanese resistance launched an aerial attack on El Yakim base using drones, scoring a direct hit. Hezbollah also shot down an Israeli Hermes 450 drone with a surface-to-air missile. Several gathering points of Israeli forces in a number of settlements were struck up by Hezbollah's rockets as well. Political analyst and former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Scott Ritter, joined us earlier to discuss Hezbollah's latest retaliatory strikes against the regime. Here's what he had to say.
Israel is unable to take its military capabilities and turn it into political victory. You know, one of the main reasons for the current Israeli escalation in Lebanon was to compel Hezbollah into a ceasefire that would allow Israel to return 60,000 of its settlers to the villages and towns in the north of Israel where they had been evacuated because of the ongoing conflict. As Hezbollah's most recent attacks show, not only is Israel unable to return the 60,000, but they're going to have to evacuate even more as Hezbollah begins this escalation. This is a devastating political failure that's brought about by the inability of the Israeli military to effectively intervene against Hezbollah. So what we're seeing here with this attack by Hezbollah is proof positive that Hezbollah's capabilities have not been interdicted, that Hezbollah retains the ability not only to strike Israel, but to gather intelligence, to incorporate this intelligence, to pick targets carefully, and then to attack these targets. You know, Hezbollah is far from defeated, and it appears that Hezbollah is more than capable of continuing this this war of attrition, this escalating war of attrition.
Let us now cross over live to the Yemeni town of Sa'ada, where people have gathered again on a week, as they have been on a weekly basis, in support and solidarity of the people of Gaza and Lebanon. Thousands of Yemenis are holding a huge rally in the northern city of Sa'ada in a show of solidarity with the people of Gaza and Lebanon. Protesters condemn Israel's year-long genocidal war on Gaza, calling for an immediate ceasefire and an end to the bloodshed in the besieged territory. They are also expressing solidarity with the Lebanese people who are facing deadly Israeli aggression against their country. Yemenis also voiced support for their armed forces' operations against Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea. Those operations have been ongoing for almost a year now to press Israel to end its aggression in West Asia. So once again, you're watching live footage of the Yemeni city, northern city of Sa'ada, where the Yemeni people have been gathering on a weekly basis in support of the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people, and also against the aggression of Israel on those countries and those nations. And they are saying that they vowed to continue the rallies and their support while the aggression goes on. The Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza, killing more Palestinians and targeting a school, sheltering displaced people in the besieged territory. In the latest attacks, three Palestinians, including a child and a woman, were killed in the regime's bombings in central city of Deir al-Balah. In a separate attack, two more Palestinians lost their lives in the town of An-Nasr, northeast of Rafah city. The attacks come after a devastating attack on a school-turned-shelter in Gaza City, which killed at least four Palestinians. The school, located in the Nusayrat refugee camp, was heavily shelled on Thursday. Since the onset of the US-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza in October last year, more than 43,700 Palestinians have been killed. Over 103,000 have been injured. For more on this, I am now joined by Professor Saad Nirm, Professor of Political Science from Bir Zayt University. Very good to have you on the program, Professor. What do you think about these latest developments in the region?
Well, if we are talking about the Gaza front, it's quite clear that the Israelis are still going on with their genocidal war, especially in the north of Gaza, Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and the area, in order to evacuate all the Palestinian people from these areas. That goes with the plan that they put forward just a few weeks ago, and now we are talking about more than 42 days of this campaign into Gaza and into north of Gaza, and especially Jabalia refugee camp. The idea of this plan was to evacuate totally north of Gaza and to push all the people to further to the south in order to make this area clear and fine without any kind of people living in there. The Israeli orders to the Palestinians were to evacuate the area, and those who don't want to evacuate, then they will be considered as enemy and they will be targeted. And so far, we are talking more than 2,000 Palestinians who have been killed in Jabalia and the surrounding area since this operation started 42 days ago. But at the same time, there is something quite important to notice, that on the one hand, you have the Palestinian resistance still working there, and they are still giving the Israeli lots of casualties, whether in their vehicles or in their lives. And also the other thing, which is the people of Jabalia is also refusing to leave. We are talking about now more than 80,000 Palestinians who are still in Jabalia, and they refuse to leave in spite of the fact that Israelis saying that they are going to target them directly, and they are saying that We don't want to leave this area because by the end of the day, we don't want to be a refugee in another place where also it is not safe, and the Israelis are continuing to target the Palestinians even in their tents somewhere else. So we are going to stay where we are, and we are not going to leave. So these factors making this Israeli operation for the last 42 days difficult to achieve and failure to achieve, if you like. And at the same time, that caused a heavy casualties among the Palestinian people, that the Israelis are targeting everything. And there is no now the problem with the north of Gaza. It's not only that the Israelis are targeting the Jabalia refugee camp, but also they are inflicting kind of war against them.
Thank you, Doctor. Really interesting to know your perspective on the matter. Professor Saad Naim, Professor of Political Science, who joined us from Beirut University. The United Nations Security Council's elected member states have circulated a new draft resolution on Gaza, calling for an immediate end and unconditional ceasefire in the war-wracked territory. The UNSC's 10 elected members sent a draft to the 5 permanent members, voicing deep concern over the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza amidst the Israeli genocide. The draft expresses the Council's deep alarm over the lack of adequate healthcare services and the state of food insecurity, which has created a risk of famine, in particular in northern Gaza. It also called for immediate access for Palestinians in Gaza to humanitarian aid. Ecuador, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, Switzerland, Algeria, Guyana, South Korea, Sierra Leone, and Slovenia circulated the draft. The United States, which is Israel's closest ally, has a long history of vetoing anti-regime resolutions. Russia, China, Britain, and France are expected to support the resolution or abstain. The US-Israeli genocide continues unabated in Gaza, bringing much of the territory's vital infrastructure to its knees. That includes water resources at a coastal sliver. The Gaza municipality said in a harrowing revelation that the Israeli military has destroyed over 105,000 water lines and 70% of the territory's water wells. It added that limited capabilities of the municipality hinder its ability to solve the crisis, forcing citizens to transport water manually to their homes. The municipality noted that there has been a sharp rise in clean water prices due to increased cost of fuel, further exacerbating the suffering of Gaza citizens. The Israeli aggression against Gaza began last October. The regime has been working to destroy all aspects of life in Gaza since then. Pro-Palestine protesters have rallied in the French capital Paris ahead of a UEFA Nations League match between France and Israel. Protesters gathered near Stade de France Stadium to express support for Palestinians in Gaza amid the incessant Israeli strikes against the besieged strip. The demonstrators also chanted slogans in support of the Palestinian resistance. They condemned the French government for hosting the match as the Israeli regime continues its Gaza genocide and Lebanon carnage. The protest was held amid tight security measures. Paris police said 2,500 officers deployed around the stadium where the match was held. Outside the stadium, however, the protests stayed put, calling for Israeli teams to be banned from sport events.
When Russia went to war against Ukraine, they were banned from all sports. Despite the genocide in Gaza, the fact that they kill women, children, men can be victims too. Israelis allowed to play a match. We are told sports and politics should be separate. Well, no. If we give them that right, then we're complicit in their murder.
The protest comes a week after pro-Palestine rallies in the Dutch capital Amsterdam. The rallies erupted after the football match between the Maccabi Tel Aviv and Ajax Amsterdam, when some Israeli fans were caught on camera tearing up Palestinian flags and chanting anti-Arab slogans. In response, pro-Palestine activists clashed with the Israelis, prompting the police to intervene. In the occupied West Bank, 2 Palestinian miners sustained injuries from Israeli forces' live fire in a town near Nablus. The regime's troops also shot and wounded 2 other young Palestinians in the town of Sinjil, north of Ramallah. Our West Bank correspondent Nakahama joined us earlier with more details.
Incursions have increased actually over here in the West Bank. For today we are talking about an incursion that has been done to Sinjar, to Kinkeret, to Jenin, Al-Khalil. Most of the Palestinians' main city were under raids today. In Sinjar specifically, two Palestinian youths have gunshot wounds from the IOF while being in their village. They are with a boat shot. They were both 15 years old youth shot in their legs, and later they were taken to a hospital, a nearby hospital. Also in the area of Tulkarem and Jenin and Qalqilia, many raids and incursions have been done to these cities. And as the IOF always says, under the pretense of pursuing resistance-related Palestinians or resistance fighters, wanted resistance fighters in these areas. Well, the main headline today over here in the West Bank was not only these incursions, but was the increasing road closures and the hardships that Palestinians have been facing over here, at least for the last month. And of course, since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea says it has successfully tested suicide drones, with leader Kim Jong-un ordering their mass production. Kim oversaw the test of the kamikaze drones designed to hit both land and sea targets. North Korean media said the drones flew various routes and accurately struck targets. The North Korean leader stressed the need to build a serial production system as early as possible. Kim said drones were easy to make at a low cost for a range of activities. Tensions are running high on the Korean Peninsula. In October, the North amended its constitution to define South Korea as a hostile state. The DPRK has repeatedly described the US-led war games in the region as provocative and a rehearsal for invasion.
World is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out. and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
The Limelight.
Nearly 100 Palestinian women face conditions beyond all imaginable limits, including overcrowding, confiscations of hijabs, and medical neglect by the Zionist regime. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Israeli prison authorities have intensified abuses against Palestinian women prisoners in recent months, detainees, relatives, and a monitoring group have said. According to the Palestinian Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs Commission, women prisoners have been subjected to regular strip searches, arbitrary room inspections, and confiscation of clothes and other essential items. At least 94 female prisoners in the Daman prison are suffering in worsening conditions that are beyond all imaginable limits, the commission said in a statement recently. The commission said, hundreds of testimonies from prisoners reveal shocking and horrific accounts of what has occurred and is going to occur against both male and female prisoners, basing its statement on recent visits made by lawyers to the prisoners. The statement added, this includes the testimonies of female prisoners from Gaza who have faced violations and crimes more severe and cruel than ever since the war began. The retaliatory measures taken by the Zionist regime authorities include the confiscation of additional hijabs, shoes, and other clothing items. Hadil Hassanein, the sister of imprisoned journalist Rula Hassanein, said her unwell sister was suffering complications due to the denial of medical treatment in prison. Hadil told Middle East Eye she suffers from severe headaches and persistent high blood pressure. She added, Recently, she underwent tests at the prison clinic, but no treatment was provided despite the results indicating blood in her kidney. Rula was kidnapped from her home in Beit Lahm in the occupied West Bank on March 19th, Hadil said. Her recently born infant child is also experiencing multiple health issues, primarily because of being unable to breastfeed. The child was born prematurely at 7 months and requires special care. Hadil added, the baby's respiratory system has been particularly affected, compounded by the cold weather and low immunity. The Zionist Ofer Prison Military Court has issued two orders for her release that were rejected by the Zionist regime military prosecution, according to Hadil. Talal Nasser, a lawyer at Ramallah-based NGO Al-Zamir, which defends the rights of Palestine prisoners, said medical negligence and overcrowding have been rampant. Nasser told Middle East Eye, female prisoners are given very little time outdoors, mainly for showering, as the showers are outside the cells. Additionally, the Israeli Prison Administration deliberately withholds cleaning supplies in Damon Prison, which has led to an increase in skin infections due to overcrowding. Most prisoners are forced to sleep on the floor. Among the most prominent violations faced by female prisoners is strip searches. Under the guise of security procedures, female prisoners are forced to remove all clothing while also enduring verbal abuse and ill-treatment. The family of Zahra Khodroj, 53, from Galgilia, remains deeply concerned about her welfare amid the ongoing violations against female detainees. Her husband, Abdul Latif Abu Safaqa, told Middle East Eye she was kidnapped at home on January 28 and remains in detention awaiting a court hearing. Abu Safaqa said, "When we hear what happens in prisons, we are very worried. The strip searches are humiliating and degrading to our women, and no action is taken to stop this horrific abuse." He added, "We don't even know if she has been subjected to this treatment." Khodroj, a mother of seven, ran a center for prisoner studies in Galgilia to assist the families of detainees. She holds a doctorate in human development, a higher diploma in nursing, and a master's degree in environmental sciences. She has also authored 14 books on various subjects. Her husband said, "It is tragic that a woman with such experience is still behind bars without charge. These actions reflected a state without morals." Another common practice of Zionist regime prisoner authorities is depriving detainees of sufficient food. According to numerous testimonies, the daily food rations provided by the Zionist regime prison administration barely constitute half of a normal meal. Bara Fokaha described widespread deprivation that female detainees are subjected to. In her lawyer's last visit to her, her father, Hatem Fokaha, said, "We go to bed hungry," was the most distressing statement in her letter, he said, adding, "I can't bear to think of my daughter going to sleep hungry while we have access to all kinds of food." Bara, a medical student at Al-Quds University, was kidnapped at a military checkpoint near Nablus on August 14th while returning to her home in Tulkarm from university. She was placed in administrative detention without charge or trial for 6 months, which can be extended arbitrarily and indefinitely. A year before her arrest, she had been banned from entering the university for several months due to her participation in student activism. Fokaha said, "One of the things that bothers the female prisoners most, according to her lawyer, is the continuous and violent raids and searches, which occur nearly every week. Some prisoners have been punished for trivial reasons, including solitary confinement without justification."
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
The discourse within Zionist Israel regarding the war in Lebanon is increasingly marked by criticism fueled by a belief among many that the Israeli occupation army has made notable gains by targeting Hezbollah's leadership and dismantling its water infrastructure. As a result, pressure is mounting on the government to seek a political settlement. The debate over a political settlement is becoming inseparable from the realities on the battlefield as fears mount over Hezbollah's resilience and its capacity to strike back, eroding Zionist Israel's gains and risking a prolonged entanglement in Lebanon. In the Zionist daily newspaper Yediot Ahronot, Yossi Yehoshua, under the headline "A Settlement or War of Attrition and Security Belt," cited a senior Israeli entity officer who explained that while the occupation army is expanding its ground operations into strategically significant areas, difficult questions are arising. Capturing villages, he noted, won't bring a resolution without a lasting agreement. The army will have to ramp up efforts to push Hezbollah, the Lebanese government, and key intermediaries from the U.S. to Russia towards conditions favorable to Zionist Israel. Yet operational reports indicate a challenging reality. Despite a month of ground fighting, five Israeli enemy divisions and a reserve brigade, over 50,000 troops, triple the number deployed in the 2006 Lebanon War, have made minimal advances in southern Lebanon. Despite overwhelming firepower and air support, they have been unable to capture even a single village. This failure is attributed to Hezbollah's sophisticated defensive tactics, which include a mix of fixed and mobile defense lines armed with precise anti-armor projectiles. Concealment strategies have kept the group's firing positions largely undetectable, frustrating Israeli enemy advances. Now, the difficult terrain has limited the effectiveness of Israeli entity air support, pushing the occupation army toward more war crimes, further targeting infrastructure and civilian areas. The newspaper's report further highlights that these setbacks stem from the challenge of accurately mapping Hezbollah's positions. Every attempt to advance is met with concentrated fire, intensified by small drones that the Israeli occupation forces find very hard to counter. What is happening on the ground is that Hezbollah's fighters strategically allow the Israeli occupation army to advance only to set ambushes, creating a nightmarish scenario for troops, even those in elite units like Golani and other commandos. This makes the potential human cost of any such advance staggering, possibly surpassing the total casualties sustained by the Israeli occupation army throughout its conflicts since the late 1940s, including the ongoing Al-Aqsa flood operation. Ammar Osman. So a Zionist Israeli newspaper reported that despite deploying over 50,000 troops in southern Lebanon, the Israeli military has yet to capture even a single village. Yediot Ahronot noted that after a month of operations involving five divisions, three times the force used in 2006 war, Zionist Israel has failed to secure any foothold in the area. To discuss this issue with us via Zoom is Dr. Danielle Yagich, professor of media studies at the Lebanese American University and political commentator. A pleasure having you with us, Danielle. Now, what do you think are the key reasons behind the Israeli occupation army's inability to capture any villages in southern Lebanon, despite deploying over 50,000 troops? And how do you think Hezbollah's tactical defenses of Hezbollah contributed to this failure?
Well, I think the current failure that we see once again with the Israeli regime's another attempt to invade Lebanon shows once again what has been the case historically so many times, which is that the south of Lebanon represents a graveyard for the Israeli army. If we were to approach a question about the failure, I think there are different angles, one of which, of course, is the ideological question here, because in this case, once again, the colonizer is confronted with a native people that are on their native land and is trying to advance from one stolen land, which is Palestine, to another, which is Lebanon, through relentless terror against the resistance. In particular, in the past weeks, we've seen the Israeli terror attacks all over Lebanon, sabotage, infiltration, assassination of leaders, and of course, a relentless bombardment. But it was not able to weaken the resistance. On the contrary, because the Israeli regime cannot disconnect people from their land, and the continuous Israeli aggression reiterates, again, resistance. And I think the failure represents this very Western colonial arrogance. At the same time, of course, from a military perspective, although the Israeli regime has a superiority, especially when it comes to the aerial bombing and bombardment, it has an advanced military infrastructure, it cannot do much on the ground. The Israeli military has a history of kidnapping people, terrorizing them, terrorizing and detaining children, burning people alive, starving them. I mean, it is unspeakable, the horrors that we've witnessed, not just in the last year in Gaza, but also throughout the past decades. But it has not been able to actually stand against an actual military force, which is Hezbollah, despite, and that's the other layer to answer this question, the geopolitical implications, because in the end, this is a U.S.-Israeli war that is being fought against the people of the region. The Israeli regime represents a proxy of the West. It would not have been able to advance even until now without this maximum support it gets in military infrastructure and, of course, the entire media imperialist framework. And despite these collective Western efforts in unleashing this genocide against Western Asia and the Israeli regime's unlimited access to those resources, it has not been able to advance, which I think, again, reiterates the power of the resistance. And, of course, add to that the many different forms and attempts to destabilize the resistance from within Lebanon via U.S. proxies in Lebanese politics and media. And again, the Israeli regime is still losing. And we could very well cite Martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who, after the liberation of Lebanon and beyond, reminded us that the Israeli regime is, in fact, weaker than a spider's web.
I hear you there, but how do you think the operational report indicating the Israeli occupation army's minimal advances reflect on the maybe overall strategy of the Israeli entity government? And what does this suggest about the potential for probably a prolonged war against Lebanon?
Yes, so the question of time and a prolonging of the war is a very interesting one here, because on the one hand, the Israeli regime is losing on the ground. At the same time, it would benefit from prolonging the war, but the question is if it could have the capacity to continue. The other question, of course, is what would even be the Israeli strategy, because there doesn't seem to be one militarily. We remember the Netanyahu regime had outlined as its particular goals to justify once again the invasion of Lebanon by returning the settlers from northern occupied Palestine back to the settlements and to destroy the Lebanese resistance. As a result of the continuous Israeli war on Lebanon, more settlers have been displaced within occupied Palestine of 48. And of course, it is impossible to destroy the Lebanese resistance. So it is a strategic failure if there is even any strategy to advance these proclaimed goals of the Israeli regime. And so it has continued to resort to indiscriminately bombard civilians. And at the same time, of course, while the Israeli regime is spreading death and destruction in Palestine and Lebanon, we need to keep in mind that its own economy has been suffering. It is in a perpetual crisis. The Israeli regime is intensifying a war it cannot win. And a part of its strategy, at least in its communication, has recently included an implication of sectarianism against the Lebanese population, in particular the anti-incitement from the regime. And so I think what we see more recently is, again, more into the direction of genocide and trying to create chaos, at least to some extent, within Lebanon by seeking to destroy its economy, to sabotage the daily lives of Lebanese civilians. And it has to be seen to what extent this will be effective on behalf of the Zionist regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering the current military stalemate, Dr. Danielle, what would be a possible way out of the Lebanon swamp, if you will, for the Zionists in the form of a political settlement, maybe? And how does this factor into Hezbollah's calculations for future resistance if it were to include retreating till the Litani River, God forbid?
I think any political settlement will always be a compromise as long as the Israeli regime exists in its current form. We have to be very clear, the source of the ongoing suffering is the existence of the Israeli regime as a settler colonial regime. And at the same time, any cessation of hostilities is a threat to the regime, because in the end, the Israeli project necessitates perpetual warfare, because it can only exist as long as it kills and or subjugates anyone and everything that stands in its way. I think a political settlement is unlikely, because of course the Israeli regime exists outside of treaties, outside of the frameworks of international law or mechanisms of the international community, while it enjoys the maximum protection of the United States and represents its a proxy. So any form of communication of the Israeli regime is violent and only knows violence. And when it comes to the ongoing questions and implications about the Litani River that we also hear oftentimes in relation to the UN resolutions that are being brought up in discussions quite often these days, they themselves, all of these proposals, including the UN resolutions, have always been in favor of the Israeli regime, because there is no way to enforce those. So from the beginning, these are attempts to weaken Lebanon, to weaken its resistance, and to put it farther within the U.S. influence, which I think is another structural problem here, because as long as the broader issues, such as the U.S. grip on Lebanese internal politics and its security situation, are not addressed structurally, any sort of negotiations or compromises would always go against the resistance and, as such, against the security and prosperity of the Lebanese population.
I see where you're going, and that's a major concern for most of the Lebanese people, especially those who are supportive of the resistance. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Danielle Yagich, professor of media studies at the Lebanese American University and political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show, Professor. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we have Hezbollah's new vanguard.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Let's delve now into the pivotal shift within Hezbollah's leadership amid a turbulent battlefield reality. Following the assassination of Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Sheikh Naim Qassem has stepped in, reaffirming the resistance core principles and pushing back against Israeli entity claims of victory and political change. His first address highlights Hezbollah's resilience, challenging Netanyahu's narrative and signaling a new phase in the ongoing confrontation. More details in the following report.
In the wake of enduring severe blows over the past month, including the assassination of the revered martyred leader, Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah has announced the election of a new Secretary General and has successfully filled the vacancies left by the initial phase of Zionist-Israeli aggression. Such a pivotal development challenges the narrative propagated by Benjamin Netanyahu, which aims to uproot Hezbollah from Lebanon and push it north to the Litani River, all while attempting to reshape a new political landscape reminiscent of the treacherous 17th of May Agreement of 1983. This strategy serves as a blueprint for a so-called new Middle East that seeks to eliminate the forces of the resistance axis. While the objective of dismantling resistance movements and altering West Asia isn't new, having been echoed during the 2006 July war, Netanyahu now leans heavily on his supposed security accomplishments to drive a strategic agenda aimed at reshaping the collective consciousness of the resistance supporters, coercing them to abandon their long-held beliefs and cultural legacies. Yet, thus far, the resistance has deftly sidestepped the internal debate that Netanyahu deems essential for his aims. In his first address as the newly appointed Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim emphasized a focus on military confrontation with the entity, striving to restore equilibrium in the rules of engagement and deterrence that were unsettled in the early days of the war. His message was clear. Hezbollah is regaining its organizational and military balance, poised to outline a decisive strategy for the future on both the battlefield and the political front. Sheikh Qasim reaffirmed the party's commitment to foundational principles of the resistance, echoing the rhetoric of the party's inception back in 1982. In his inaugural address, Hezbollah's new Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim, reaffirmed his commitment to the path set by martyr leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, emphasizing that resistance and preemptive defense remain unwavering pillars of Hezbollah's strategy. But his speech went beyond homage. It was a sharp refutation of Zionist Israeli narratives that tout achievements against Hezbollah and claim shifts in the political balance across Lebanon and the region. Netanyahu's assertions, amplified by Zionist Israeli media machinery, Western outlets, and international diplomatic cover, suggest an assumption that Hezbollah's leadership would falter and bargain under pressure. Sheikh Naim Qasim, however, turned the tables, highlighting how the Zionist army's ongoing struggle against Hezbollah drones and missiles, along with its failure to hold ground in bordering villages, reflects a growing Israeli entity vulnerability.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hossein Rahal, sociology professor at the Lebanese University and political commentator. It's always a pleasure having you with us, Professor Rahal. Now, how does the election of Sheikh Naim Qasim as Hezbollah's new secretary general reflect the organization's resilience, maybe? And in what ways does it counter the Israeli entity narrative of disrupting Hezbollah's leadership structure?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate. The election of Sheikh Naim Qasim, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, represents a political and organizational response to the Zionist narrative, which claims they have succeeded in dismantling Hezbollah across military, political, and organizational fronts. However, this election by Hezbollah's leadership asserts that the party's institutional structure is resilient enough to compensate for the loss of the towering, charismatic figure of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, whose influence extended far beyond Hezbollah's base, reaching across Lebanon and the wider region. The swift decision to appoint Sheikh Qasim as the new leader is a prompt rebuttal to Zionist claims, signaling the rapid resurgence of Hezbollah's organizational and political framework. It demonstrates the party's resolve to bridge any gaps to ensure stable operations, effective leadership, and sustained political engagement. This move reassures that Hezbollah remains politically accessible to Lebanese and foreign political entities, while simultaneously upholding internal decision-making. Thus, it stands as clear evidence of Hezbollah's swift political and organizational recovery, mirroring its resilience in the military domain.
Well, Professor, given Netanyahu's ongoing strategy to try and reshape Lebanon's political landscape, particularly with comparisons to the 17th of May agreement of 1983, what challenges does Hezbollah face in countering these political maneuvers, especially within the war going on? And how effective might its resistance narrative be in at least rallying its base and broader Lebanese support as well?
In truth,
The resistance in Lebanon faces numerous challenges, and the scenario you mentioned is among the most difficult that Hezbollah and the resistance could encounter. Indeed, the Israeli enemy seeks to revive the defunct May 17 agreement, which was annulled by the Lebanese government and parliament, rendering it obsolete in Lebanon. What the Zionist enemy is now attempting is to achieve by force what it failed to secure politically in 1983. However, the situation today is very different. Back in 1982, the Israeli enemy reached Beirut within 2 to 3 weeks, and the south fell to occupation forces in just days. In contrast, now we see that frontline villages in the south, such as Ayta Shab, have withstood for over a month of ground assaults without falling. Just 2 days ago, the town of Khiam faced a fierce attack, and despite Israeli entity troops advancing only a few meters into its outskirts, they suffered significant losses and were forced to retreat. Another critical factor is Zionist Israel's internal front. The resistance has remained steadfast, demonstrating its renewed military strength. The Zionist Israelis are attempting to follow military success with political gains, hoping to impose a new reality that echoes the goals of the May 17 agreement. Yet, the resilience of the Lebanese people and political landscape poses a major obstacle to these ambitions. Just yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared his goals. First, to establish a demilitarized zone in South Lebanon, extending beyond the Litani River. And second, to secure unrestricted freedom to strike Lebanese territory, as seen in the recent kidnapping of a Lebanese citizen from Betroun in northern Lebanon. These demands represent Zionist Israel's highest objectives. However, with the continued failure of the Israeli entity's ground campaign and the resistance's success in pressuring Zionist Israel's internal front through drones and missile strikes, reaching from Kiryat Shmuna to Tel Aviv, both Zionist Israeli and American political ambitions are likely to diminish over time. In this context, the steadfastness of the Lebanese people and resistance has the potential to impose its own conditions, as ultimately, politics are shaped by realities on the ground. Nonetheless, the resistance still faces formidable challenges, including the issue of displacement, maintaining internal unity, and avoiding internal conflicts or civil strife. These are difficult issues that add to the pressure from Zionist Israeli political demands, which the resistance and the Lebanese people, especially those displaced, will not accept as terms of surrender. The displaced are prepared to endure, even with their homes destroyed and loved ones martyred, for the sake of victory, dignity, and pride. God willing, this resilience will shape the course of events, thanks to the steadfastness of the resistance fighters in southern Lebanon.
Well, Professor, with the Israeli occupation army struggling to hold ground against Hezbollah's defenses and advanced tactics, as you were explaining just now, how is Hezbollah leveraging this in its broader strategy, given that the resistance has indeed lost most of its first and second level commanders?
Yes, the resistance has indeed endured an onslaught that led to the loss of many of its leaders and experts. A fact well known. However, I can confidently say that if a large army of a major power faced the same challenges, it would struggle to recover. Yet, the resistance rebounded remarkably quickly, regaining its capabilities within 2 to 3 weeks. This swift recovery is due to its vast reserves of trained men, numerous experts, and a cadre of educated, university-trained young fighters who can step into the roles of the martyred commanders, leaders with 30 or 35 years of experience battling the Zionist enemy. This resilience has been evident on the ground. Losing some weaponry is a natural outcome when facing a formidable military force, representing not only Zionist Israeli, but also American technology. The involvement extends beyond Zionist Israel. U.S. forces, along with British and German intelligence, provide target information, weapons, and financial support to the Israeli entity. This is, in essence, a NATO front, not merely a Zionist one. Hezbollah's losses are a consequence of this intense NATO-driven pressure, initially intended for Russia. Despite these heavy losses, Hezbollah and the resistance have largely and effectively compensated, as seen in the continuous operational efficiency of its military apparatus, a fact recognized by military experts observing the battlefield. Today, we are witnessing an extraordinary display of resilience and heroism. For example, in the scenes Zionist Israel attempted to exploit, they claim to have subdued a single fighter. Yet that fighter, martyr Ibrahim Haidar, became a symbol of resistance. He held off an entire Zionist Israeli unit for hours, forcing them to resort to airstrikes to destroy the house he defended because ground forces failed to stop him. These instances showcase the resistance's operational reach, capable, in theory, of targeting Netanyahu's residence itself. Such actions demand meticulous intelligence coordination, field precision, and inter-branch coordination. The strike on the Golani Brigade's dining hall, which left over 80 Israeli entity soldiers dead or wounded, is further proof that losing key leaders has not destabilized Hezbollah. Initially, there may have been a slight disruption, but Hezbollah has quickly regained its footing. Today, it stands against the largest Zionist Israeli military force, backed by the world's foremost imperial and colonial power, the United States of America.
And it's a power that we absolutely 100% trust. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hussein Rahal, sociology professor at the Lebanese University and political commentator. It's a pleasure having you on with us. And now, ladies and gents, thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the most important Islamic concepts and teachings. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Alavia. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Alavian, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's episode of the program, The Teacher, we want to talk about tanasukh. We want to see what is this concept. Is it approved by Islam? And then regarding the concept of ma'ad or resurrection, does tanasukh has any place in Islamic teachings or not? Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. What is tanasukh exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To understand what really tanasukh is, first of all, it can be translated into incarnation, which means that the soul or ruh or nafs can place itself from a body to another body, from that body to another body. So it means that soul and nafs would remain upon this earth and does not move or does not transcend itself to the higher levels of the world.
All right.
So that is why it says that when a person dies, then the ruh or the nafs and the soul of this person moves from his body to a new body,
mm-hmm.
and then it will remain there After the death of the second person, it moves to the third body, and the fourth body, it continues.
All right.
So it means that nafs and soul is always here in this earth, on this planet, and does not move to anywhere else, and always change its body from one body to another body. Because it is totally different from ma'ad, which we believe in Islam. Ma'ad, or resurrection, means that we believe that only soul once live inside a body.
All right.
After death, it moves to some other kind of realms or domains of this universe.
Mm-hmm.
It will not remain in this world. So that's why tanasukh or incarnation is different from resurrection or believing resurrection.
All right.
And of course, we have different types of tanasukh that we will be, inshallah, discussing.
So in any way, tanasukh is not approved by Islam?
Of course not.
Okay, it's not. Okay. Brother Alevian, do you agree that tanasukh is not approved at all by any Muslim scholar or Muslims?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his beautiful project. Actually, answering this question of yours, I have to say that there are some scholars, even in Islam world, that they agree with this concept of reincarnation. But majority, I mean, I can say almost 99%+ of the scholars usually disagree. And I mean, this disagreement is a valid disagreement. I can even get out of, I mean, this circle of Islam and even in Abrahamic religions, even